Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Gabby Roslin. Hello and welcome to That Gabby Roslin Podcast, part of the Acast Creator Network. Jim Broadbent is a true gent. What an actor and what a career. I can't begin to tell you what a thrill it was for me to sit face to face with this talented, charming man and have the opportunity to talk about his life. He speaks so fondly about his childhood and his caring parents. We discuss his excellent new movie, The Duke, which in my very humble opinion is one of the greatest British films of all time. He really is a very special man, and I so hope you enjoy listening. Please, can I ask you a favour? Would you mind following and subscribing, please? By clicking the follow or subscribe button. This is completely and utterly free, by the way. And you can also rate and review on Apple Podcasts, which is the purple app on your iPhone or iPad. Simply scroll down to the bottom of all of the episodes. I know there have been quite a few now. And you'll see the stars where you can tap and rate and also please write a review. Thank you so much. I was watching, of all the things, and we're going to talk about so much, Jim, but talking about Brian on the Magic Roundabout. I don't know why, when you suddenly said hello, and started, I thought, oh, that was a moment yesterday, listening to you being Brian.
Really? Yeah, well, that's not often mentioned.
What, that and the trumpet in Teletubbies?
Yeah, oh, right, well, yes, it's all age-related, isn't it?
I don't know what I was... You know what it was? It was nostalgia from my childhood watching The Magic Roundabout, because it was one of those shows that we'd say goodnight and we'd go upstairs.
Yeah. It used to come out just before the news, I think. My father used to watch The Magic Roundabout and he just got a telly, I think. And
It was a while ago. It was a while ago when it first came out. I think it was black and white when it first came out, but you've revoiced it. But actually, if I may, I'd love to talk about your parents because they sound incredible. So they were both sculptors, artists, and amateur dramatic
players. Yeah, bit of all of that. My father, he trained in architecture and in London, and then just prior to the war, and my mother at the same time. They met at Leeds Art School, and then they both came to London. My mother went to the Royal Academy Schools to do sculpture, and my father went to the Courtauld and the Architectural Institute, didn't finish either course. And then the war came, and because of their pacifist feelings and ethics, they decided to go into agriculture in Lincolnshire. And to help the war effort as pacifists. And my father, with a bit of private income and along with another man who also had a young man who had a bit of private income, they rented this farm in Lincolnshire and set it up as an educational, agricultural educational community for other pacifists who wanted to find what they could do to help the war effort without going to the war.
How wonderful. What a way to be brought up with people. I'm sorry for sounding trite, but was it a very peaceful, loving
childhood? Well, it was really. I mean, because so an awful lot of young people went to this community and did their training, and a number of them stayed. And so that was the... And then I wasn't born till 1949. So, but that was the group of families that I grew up with, really, had all gone to Lincolnshire in pursuit of this education in agriculture. But they were sort of vaguely or pretty much liberal, left-wing, artistic group of agricultural and artistic people, really.
So where did the amateur dramatics come into that?
Well, part of a number of the members of the community were very keen on drama, including my father, and probably he was might have been the prime mover on this. So they wanted to set up an amateur dramatic company, and which put on several plays a year in an old RAF building, and became the Holton Players. But they did things like Chekhov and Ibsen and Shaw. And
isn't that what you started doing? Didn't you start with Ibsen?
Well, I did. I was a child in the Doll's House, but I didn't do any other theatre for 20 years, really.
Except what a way to start, though. I mean, if you're going to start with Ibsen.
Yeah, started with Ibsen. But I just did a lot of sort of comedy sketches at school, but didn't really do any plays until after.
So then, but I presume your parents were very supportive of your choice of going off to Lambda.
Yeah. In fact, my father suggested it. I went to art school first for a year. And then, all my free time I spent going to the cinema. You know, it interested me far more than art and going to galleries and pursuing that. So, it was always going to be one or the other, art or acting. So in the end, I did a year at art school. Then I thought, no, if I'm honest, it's acting I really want to do. So,
but you said it was your dad who.
Yeah, my dad said, yeah, we were, while I was at art school, he came down to London and we were having a meal, and we sat next to two quite loud young people who it became clear that they were drama students, and we were sort of listening to them for a while. And then my father said, "Why don't you go to drama school?" So it was actually his suggestion. So
how wonderful!
And I said, "Well, I was thinking that. I was thinking that." So it all just timed in. So yes. Far from the usual. No, not on over my dead body. No, go and get a proper job. That wasn't the case at all. No, it was actually suggestion.
It's very interesting, though, because a lot of actors, when they go off to train, there's been this pull for years and years and years. But for you, it was that wonderful. I have that sort of that wide-eyed innocent thing of going to the cinema and thinking, wow, this is what I love. That's where it came from then. Just
but also at school doing, we did a lot of sort of review type things and wrote our own sketches and things. So, and I was always the joker in the class, you know, and so came out of that as well. But we went to the theatre an awful lot as a family, and in the local rep in Lincoln, we used to go a lot and see all the, as a very regular company right through year after year, it seemed. Mm-hmm. And I loved going and seeing all the different plays, sometimes very unsuitable ones because couldn't get a babysitter, so they took us as well. But you know, the Brendan Behan and sort of strange pieces and Tennessee Williams, things I didn't understand at all. But I loved seeing the actors coming back every week in transformed into some other character, and that is what intrigued me. You know, like one week he'd be the Juve lead, and the next week he'd be a sort of stuttering policeman, or you know, sort of. I think it was the character acting aspect that really fascinated me about the old rep theatre system. You know.
It's a shame that's not there anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it was. I don't know what the actual. I can't remember what the actual quality of the work was, but.
It was wonderful.
Yeah, it was, absolutely. And then I got into Fringe Theatre, which is, the 70s, 80s, the Fringe Theatre and the rep system both worked together and influenced each other and supported each other. So, but even that's gone now and not to the same extent at all.
But there are so many wonderful little venues and little theatres, and I think the past 2 years... in lockdown and everything, it does worry me that because it's such an important part of a community and that they don't get the funding and that so many of them are turning into
I don't know, wine bars or whatever.
Yeah.
I just think it's a shame because bringing theatre into the heart of a small community is, I mean, you just when you talk about it, your eyes are lighting up and you remember it as a child.
Yeah, yes, I mean, it's a very different world. Young actors or young people who want to become actors say, oh, how do I do it? I haven't a clue now. No, the system has changed. It's a different route.
Yeah, a lot of people just want to be famous these days, which
it is
also,
it's true. Yeah.
Strange old thing. We have to talk, obviously, about the Duke. I'm going to embarrass you. So there we go. There's the warning. Embarrassing thing coming. I think that the Duke is up there in the top five British films ever.
Really?
My husband and I watched it twice. So we were sent a special link. We watched it and then we watched it again the next night to show our 15-year-old daughter. And we both have not stopped talking about it. We love that film.
Oh, brilliant. That's not embarrassing. It'd be embarrassing if you didn't like it.
Oh, I see.
If you hated it.
No, we got you here. Now, let me just tell you, Jim. No, it's just, it's got everything. It's beautiful. It's poignant. It's passionate. You love him so much when you're watching it and you're cheering him on. And because it's a real story, I then went and did all the reading about it as well. But so, some people may not have seen it. Actually, it should be a law that everyone sees it. That's how I feel about this film. You have to see it. So for people who don't know, this is a true story. It happened in 1961, didn't it?
Yes, in 1961, the nation bought Goya's portrait of the Duke of Wellington for £140,000, which is the highest they'd ever paid for a painting. And it was shown in the National Gallery, big event. And Kempton Bunton took exception to the fact that the government had spent £140,000 on this painting. And he was a sort of bit of a chancer, had numerous jobs in Newcastle, a working class chap, but he was passionate about various causes, one of which was that old age pensioners should have free TV licences. And he had made this a cause for some time. And then when the painting was displayed and it was announced that it cost £140,000, he took exception to this and thought that this was iniquitous. And then the painting was stolen and big headlines everywhere. And Kempton wrote letters to the newspapers in the old way of cutting. No, he didn't cut out the letters from newspapers. He actually tried to disguise his handwriting and said he'd give it back if the nation gave free TV licences to war widows and old age pensioners. And so it went on, and he wrote a lot of letters, and his letters were published in the Daily Mirror, and finally the story was going to come out, so he gave it back, and he went on trial.
And the trial is just, I mean, everything about it is beautiful. And there's incredible touches. I mean, I actually felt that, because the way it's been intercut with real footage as well, and you feel that you're there in those times. But the trial is just, I mean, we were sitting there cheering and clapping, and that films don't often do that to you.
I love the film too, and it's not always the case. I love my own work, but it was the writing was so deft, so subtle. I mean, turning on from drama and family drama to this courtroom drama, and every aspect of it is beautifully written. And then we had just the most wonderful director and Roger Michel, who sadly died.
Oh, I'm so sorry about that.
Which is just dreadful. But one of Roger's great things was casting. He was, and every single character. I love watching the film to see all these other actors who they come in for a day or two, but just impeccably cast and impeccable. I mean, the people who come round the TV licensed detector van people, I mean, just exquisite bits of acting right across the board, and Roger was responsible for that, apart from everything else. Roger was a superb, wonderful director, and
we had
such a great time.
I interviewed him a couple of times, actually, over the years. And what a gentleman.
Yeah.
He was so lovely. I'm so sorry. I mean, he died far, far too young. It was only last year. And I wish, I hope that he's up there watching now as people applaud this magnificent film.
Brilliant. Well, thank you.
I really do. I really do. So the playing real people, and you've, and I know everybody always says this to you, but you know, you've made a career of a lot of real people that existed, not just fictional characters. Is that more fun? Is it more interesting to do?
I love that. Yeah,
you do.
And real people is so complicated and so interesting, so contradictory. I mean, very often in fictional characters, they're there to play one aspect of a character or a couple. I mean, no. But real people are so extraordinarily interesting, and it's depending if they're, you know, sort of 20th century and you've got, you know, recordings of their voice and film of them moving around, that's a real help for the actors.
So do you do that? How do you do it? Do you think, okay, I'm acting as that person, or I'm going to get under the skin and do their voice? And
well, a bit of for something like Lord Longford and John Bailey in Iris, Iris Murdoch's husband, I play, where there's voice recordings and to listen to it. And the voice particularly, you try and get the voice right, and that reveals so much, and then you get under the skin of it. But having that sort of, in a way, surface information can then let you get right inside and underneath.
How do you do that then? Do you listen to a recording and then repeat it and look in the mirror? How do you get the voice right?
No, just listen to it, really. And don't look in the mirror particularly. But just get the voice. And there was another character I played on years ago, and he was Colonel Wintle. He was a very eccentric man. And the voice was so informative, and he had been on Desert Island Discs. He was extraordinary, but the voice was so informative that it just gets that. And one of his lines was, "There was only one war with the Germans. It lasted 30 years with a lull in the middle while they regrouped." You see, getting his voice, and it just sort of informed the whole character. Yeah, so, and it's such a lovely voice to capture, you know, sort of.
But what happens if that person is alive and are you more aware then that they're going to see you being them?
I don't know if I've done one. Anyone who's actually alive, and certainly, I mean, with Lord Longford, all his family, that was that was a responsibility to be taking on such a, you know, sort of well-known figure, and his children, grandchildren, all still very much with us. But in the end, you're making a fiction, you know. The script is made up. You're not really being them. You're being a version of them from known facts, but and most of it is invented. And however I play it, it's going to look more like me than it does like them.
Well, there's some Lord Longford. You looked extraordinarily like him. I mean,
some good makeup and prosthetic chin, I think. Yes, a prosthetic chin. Maybe nose as well, was it? I can't quite remember. But yes, there was a lot of time in makeup and weird hair. That helps. But we did go to we filmed in a lot of prisons, because he was always, every week he'd go to some prisoner in the country. And we went to one prison, and one of the warders was heard to say, "Oh, God, I thought we'd got rid of that bastard." Because he was obviously a pain in their side.
But Dennis Thatcher as well, of course. Didn't you play Dennis Thatcher? Oh, my God.
With Meryl. Meryl Streep.
Yes.
yes, that was an event. Yes, she's amazing. It was a slightly strange one, because I was playing Dennis as a figment of her imagination rather than being in sort of naturalistic. Sometimes you can really get into it and identify with the character and feel you're getting it to your own satisfaction anyway. But Dennis was a tricky one, I think. From just physically, I didn't feel I had that look in the same way.
I think you're fantastic.
Oh,
Meryl, so, I mean, the people, there you are saying, talking about Meryl Streep and Dame Judy and, we'll get on to Moulin Rouge in a minute because that is my go-to. I think I watch it twice a year. But all of these magnificent people, they all say, Lindsay Duncan, when I interviewed you and you were there with Lindsay as well, they all say, they all feel the same sort of people. They all, there's the kindness. And do you think that's important when working on a film or in a theatre show? And our mutual friend, Sam Spira, all these people, they all just, they speak so fondly of you, I have to say. They all say that you're kind and a gentleman and you're warm and it's all about making this together. Do you think that's very important? Is that the way you've always been?
I think it's the way everyone I like working with works. You know, it's such a sort of privileged job to be doing, and there's no time or reason to be moaning and being difficult. And it doesn't help if you moan and difficult. They think, oh, we won't have him for this next job. He's a bit of a moaner, and so
you must have worked with moaners though.
Yeah, not too many. I mean, because the I'm quite picky, and most of the, you know, I think, you know, the people, directors I've worked with, a lot of them I've worked with a few times, and it's because you think, they're good to work with, and they understand the business, and they know how to cast people who aren't difficult. And so generally, all the work I do it's a very happy atmosphere and very easy because we're all coming from the same place, really. So sometimes do a job which is slightly out of my usual sort of realm and think, this is a little bit trickier. I've got to work harder at this, and it's a little bit frustrating. And it does get frustrating sometimes. Filming's awful.
Overrun
and you're hanging around and. But I'm quite good at hanging around and not driving myself mad. Some people just can't stand the hanging around and waiting, so they get a bit grumpy. But
what do you do when you're having to hang around?
Read crosswords, natter if there's somebody else to hang around with. But I'm quite good at that, doing nothing.
It's very interesting you say about how lucky you are and that people shouldn't moan. I do, you know, I get frustrated by people who are, I mean, I'm living my dream job. You're obviously so happy with what you do. But when people, just think about all the people that do the jobs that they really hate.
No, nothing annoys me more than a moaning film star. You know, somebody who has all that luck, really. And I mean, and it's hard work as well. But, you know, to be in that position, you get praised and prizes and stroked and people looking after you and running around, picking you up from home, taking you back, you know, and bringing you anything you want at any time of the day. I mean, there's absolutely nothing to moan about it. And you get paid a lot and then you get prizes.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I was watching your Oscar speech.
Oh, God, I've never seen it. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, no, congratulations. It was very good. Think of me as a six-year-old child asking this. What's it like to win an Oscar? Because we all dream of it, even if we don't want to be actors.
Well, it's absolutely extraordinary.
Is it?
The build-up is, because it doesn't come out of nowhere. You get, you know, the build-up comes for months, I suppose. And
so how does it start?
I can't remember the sequence, but there's the Oscars, the BAFTAs and the Golden Globes. And Golden Globes certainly came before the Oscars, and I got a Golden Globe. So then I was suddenly much more in the frame for the Oscars when after the Golden Globes. So I suppose after the Golden Globes, there was a lot more attention, and I was in LA for quite a long time doing all that sort of press, and so it's in your head, and every day people do interviews, and I think you might get it, you know. Yeah. it's full of all that, and then, but you know, as an actor, you start off from the word go. I'd like to get an Oscar, you know. So the reality of it, when it comes closer, you think, oh, God, this is extraordinary, you know. And then to actually win an Oscar, it's bizarre.
It
seems so unlikely that something that is just a dream, you know, sort of fantasy, silly fantasy, could actually become reality. It's really hard to get your head around, and it took quite a long time. It was several times a day I think, oh, I've got an Oscar.
I love that.
That's weird, I've got an Oscar. And then thank God, finally, that faded into the background. But it was a very strange thing.
When you go up to make the speech, are you aware that it's you and you're aware that you're in that moment? Or is that one of those times that it's just like, whoa?
Sort of aware, but I forgot to mention to two of the producers, you know.
I'm sure they've forgiven you now.
Just about. It becomes very important, you realise afterwards. But who you mention in Oscar speeches.
I'm sure they've forgiven you. You can say it now if you want.
Dear Robert Fox and Scott Rudin, who should have mentioned.
Well, there we go. Now you've done it. It's fine. It's been done. The other thing that everybody always talks to you about is Only Fools and Horses. And there's the lovely story about... they wanted you originally to be Del Boy. And I know you've said the story before, but it's so interesting that young people today who weren't brought up on Only Fools and Horses are watching it all over again. It's as popular to sort of two new generations. Mm. It's quite something, that.
It's weird. It's not weird, because it's really quality writing and performing, you know, and people identify with Del Boy, so, and the whole relationships, so for all those, the family relationships, Rodney and Grandpa or Uncle, beautifully drawn characters and contrasting, and it just, they all fit so well into this comedic structure, and you know, you care about them and you laugh at them and with them all the time, and it's very special what John Sullivan did, you know, putting it together.
When you were in that, was anybody aware that all these years later it was still going to be? Did you think that? Do you know when something's got that special touch of gold glitter?
I think they did. I mean, I only went in for three episodes, so, but
you're never allowed to forget it.
Never allowed to forget it. No, I saw one the other day. I just. Class reunion episode, I thought, and it was on. I sort of hovered by the sofa while it was on, and then I sat down and watched it right through. And it was lovely! It was extraordinary. I mean, it's quite non-PC, some of it now. It's sort of it's 30 years ago, you know, but still, it's by far the most recognition I get on the street. It's for
really
Fools and Horses, yeah.
Because it's interesting, I suppose. Do you know if somebody's coming towards you? You've explained that it's Fools and Horses, but when somebody's coming towards you, do you think, they're going to mention Harry Potter, or they're going to mention
nobody mentions anything generally. They just
they don't.
The smile. Occasionally, I've been hijacked by a hen party for Bridget Jones, whose father. No, it's,
where do they take? Do they actually physically take you somewhere?
It's No. They've Hen Party's been passing and spotted me, and then, oh no, it's Bridget Jones's father. She's getting married tomorrow, and then can I have a photo, a selfie with her? But very, very rarely do people just sort of smile generally.
Because I wonder.
I don't know why they're smiling. Probably just because
they're smiling because it's you, Jim. Right. Because they love all the things. Let's talk about Moulin Rouge. That film is just it's mad in the most beautiful way. I mean, I watch it twice a year. It's my go-to. I love it. Makes me feel good. Do you have fond, extraordinary memories of that?
It really was. Yeah. We had it was very exciting to be part of. It was all filmed in Fox Studios in Sydney, and so it's going to Australia, and it's such a passionate piece of work from Baz Luhrmann's point of view. He had such a vision, and he was so excited and exciting. So we went out to Sydney for a month's rehearsal, a lot of reading of the script and working on the workshopping the script a bit, but mainly rehearsing the dancing and the singing and all that. Then I came home, and sort of Ewan and I were the main Brit-based ones, so we came home for a month or so and then went out and filmed it. But Baz had such a strong vision for it all, and he was so excited. And it was a thrill, and it was colourful, and it was strong, and we were dancing and singing every day. I was quite a challenge for both of those departments. And I did say, I'm not really a singer, Baz, I'm not or a dancer. Oh, no, we can work around that. We can work with that. And they obviously, so they did. And so I sang a lot, and it was fantastic. It was a real group, so the whole group of the Bohos, you know, with Ewan and Nicole and all of us, and it was so in that rehearsal we bonded a lot. So it's a great group feeling. It was it was a theatrical event in a way. It felt very as if we were part of a theatre company as much as a film company.
See, I'm so pleased to hear that, because watching it that's what you, I think, as an audience member, you want to hear that. When you talk about what you do, and it's wonderful to be face-to-face seeing you, because when you talk about it, your eyes light up about each time you talk about all of the different jobs you've done. And I know you use the word lucky. I use the word lucky.
I'm lucky that I was born when I was born and was a white male. You know, that's luck. You know, it was privileged from the word go, really.
No, please. That's what I want. Exactly what I want to hear. That you, I get the feeling that you feel that you're incredibly lucky, but also that you really love what you do, don't you?
Mm. Yeah, I do. Yeah, and it's part of, you know, being in a position to choose. You can choose things that you really appeal. From the word go, leaving drama school, always had a sort of, right, I will do a job if it's going to teach me something I've never done before, you know, or a character I've never done before, or working in an area I've never done before, a big theatre, a small theatre, film, a big film, a small film, to just broaden my experience all the time. So I get a huge range of things, characters that comes my way. It's not always the same thing. So I can find things that are going to entertain me. And I just think, you know, I've got to enjoy it if I want other people to enjoy what I'm doing. It's much easier to do it if I love it too. You know.
Do you say no?
I do say no quite a lot. Yeah, it's the sort of the strongest thing you've got in your armoury, really, to think, no, I won't go down that route. You can't always choose which route. You can't say, I want to go down that route, but you can say, I won't go down that one.
You have very strong political beliefs, and obviously got that from your parents. Would you say no to something that you, I mean, I get the feeling, obviously, with the Duke, it's very much, you're just as passionate as he is about
about old people having free TV licenses and things, the way you talked about it. I hope I'm not putting words into your mouth, but would you not do a role if you felt, no, this is against everything I believe in politically and fundamentally?
I would think so. It wouldn't. No, I'd probably think, no, I don't like this script. It doesn't really work for me. I don't understand it. Or I don't know how I could make this real. Or no, acting's only about making it sound. It's a false thing, but you've got to make it sound real. And if you think, I can't make this, I don't know how I could make this real, really. So that might be for all sorts of reasons. You know, like maybe I wouldn't believe in it, or just the writing doesn't sound as if it's playable. I've been one or two occasions and I thought, oh no, I don't like this. This is politically alienating to me. One or two things where the violence was so extreme, I thought, oh, I'm quite uncomfortable. Now, sometimes that's necessary, you know, part of a good script.
Do you ever think, what would Roy, your dad, what would he think if I did that? Does that ever come into your head?
He'd love my career.
Oh, that's wonderful.
He'd have been very proud of it, I'm sure. And it's his idea, you know.
Yeah.
and him having been he'd love to have been an actor, I think, really.
Do you think he would have loved The Duke?
God, he really would, yeah.
Yeah.
He'd have adored it, yeah.
As I do. I'm not your father, but I love it. You're also a graphic novelist now.
Well, I wrote a film script years ago called Dull Margaret, about a sort of witch woman who lived on the marshes. And I was going to play Margaret, was the initial idea. And I couldn't get anyone to fund it, really. We've got people, got creatives interested in doing it, you know, the directors and designers and... But couldn't get anyone to fund it. So, and I got too old to play Margaret, was splashing around in cold water. So it sort of went on the back burner for a bit. And then I thought, there was this cartoonist I'd seen in The Guardian called Dix, and I loved his work. And I thought, I wonder if I could get his email and send it to him, and with the idea of making a graphic novel. And introduce myself, and I did, and we got on famously. And he leapt at it, and he started sending me pictures of his ideas he had for Margaret and her world. He'd do it about his working hours was about 3 a.m, so I'd get up in the morning, and there would be on my fax machine or was it a fax then? I can't quite remember. Anyway, there would be or emails were stacks of these different images for Margaret, and there was a really exciting time, and he captured my vision of Margaret beautifully, really.
Any more Dull Margarets around?
That was a one-off, I think. When I'm not acting, I would find some creative outlet, and sometimes it's been writing, and sometimes it's more now, more latterly, it's been sort of sculptural creative work, more going back into the art.
Oh, goodness me. So what do you work with?
All sorts of different materials, and it's making characters, really, sometimes wood carving in wood and then modelling in clay, or modelling in this stuff called Sculpey, which is like plasticine, but you can bake it hard and paint it, and so just all sorts of different. But they're always people. They're just. Different extreme characters.
Oh, I love that. Where do you do it at home, or have you got a studio?
Got a studio space in West London, yeah, which I go in and do a bit.
How wonderful!
And my wife's got, she's a painter, and she has a studio space in the same building. So I've sort of climbed in there.
So while she's busy painting, you're in the corner with your, what's it called? Dance, the plasticine stuff?
It's called Sculpey.
Sculpey. I quite like the sound of that.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. You can just, and then you just bake it in the oven for half an hour, and it's rock hard. And then you can paint it and chisel it, or whatever you want to do with it.
So we're going to be seeing an exhibition of your work soon.
Well, I've shown a bit of it in open studios once, I've got quite a stack of stuff now. I'll have to show it properly at some stage.
Oh, do. Well, you say that you like to do things that you learn new things, or you.
pushing yourself. That's the next thing.
That uses up my creative energy when I've not got any acting I want to do particularly.
But I can imagine that you don't have much downtime because I suppose it's nothing to do with you, of course, but how that's scheduled. So how things come out. And I know you did film, you filmed The Duke a while ago now because of COVID, it had to be held back and held back. It was Venice as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The first show.
We filmed it just before lockdown. So that was finished filming in February 2020. Yeah.
Yeah.
In about March, I think, March 2020. So we finished filming just before lockdown and we opened up and went to Venice and it was a huge, just Roger and I went to Venice and Nicky Bentham, the producer, and it had a great success in Venice. And then opening was delayed and delayed, which is just very sad, really. Roger died before we had a proper opening. He went to Telluride with Helen Mirren. They were in Telluride together. I couldn't go because of COVID and another job coming up. But then that was successful there as well. So he got a taste of how we knew how popular it was going to be. So, and he died suddenly. You know, so.
Yeah, like I said,
it's just awful.
I'm so sorry. I know that it's very hard for you to talk about that because I know how close you were. But as I said, he'll be watching down. It is a beautiful film, and I honestly want to now go and watch it for the third time because just talking about it again. I think it's something very, very special. So thank you. Thank you for bringing us that film. Thank you for bringing me that man because I didn't know anything about it. I mean, it was before I was born and now I just keep reading everything I can. So thank you for that. But also, we always ask everybody in this podcast what makes you belly laugh. But I wonder, are you a giggler? I get the feeling that you're very, you like to sit back, you watch everything going on. But I sort of imagine that there are times when I can see it in your eye when I said that.
Yes, sometimes it's the most delicious experience is when you're laughing and you just can't stop. And you're out of control with laughter. And it doesn't happen as much as it used to, I suppose, as you get old. But it still happens occasionally, and it's a delight. And there's a friend of mine, Patrick Barlow, and we were the National Theatre of Brent a long time ago now, 30 years ago. But we used to create plays together, which was quite cult and popular at the time. And then big epic dramas, the Bible or whatever, just performed by two inadequate men. And just Patrick was the driving force, but working on those shows, sometimes we would be weeping with laughter with our director Martin Duncan, and we would just hold up rehearsals for about half an hour while we just laughed, and it's still one of the most glorious memories I have.
You know what, Jim? You just bring so much joy through all of the films, but each time I've met you, I think you really are somebody so incredibly special. So thank you so much. And when you just talked about that laughter, you had that twinkle in your eye, and may it carry on forever. Jim, thank you.
Thank you very much. That was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Coming up on the next episode of the podcast, I'm going to be chatting with TV star, all-round fabulous actress, Jill Halfpenny.
That Gabby Roslin podcast is proudly produced by Cameo Productions. Music by Beth Macari. Could you please tap the follow or subscribe button? And thanks so much for your amazing reviews. We honestly read every single one and they mean the world to us. Thank you so much.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to OSEAMalibu.com and use code MOM.